Okay, we don't have a quorum yet, but we can get going on the overview, because I know the commissioner has somewhere he needs to be a little later, and if we can finish early, that'd be great with me too. And we'll call the committee officially to order when we get a quorum. To begin with, we'll start with, we'll just go right to Commissioner Brenner from Department of Labor and Industry. You have an overview that you want to present to us with your staff. If you'd introduce yourself and have all the staff introduce themselves as they talk, before they talk.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Commissioner Scott Brenner. And with me today, let me initialize this conversation by introducing what I consider my senior staff that I think will be of relevance to each of you as we proceed with labor policy development over the course of this session. So then we'll move from there into our PowerPoint presentation. On my left is Assistant Commissioner Beth Hargarten. Assistant Commissioner Hargarten oversees the workers' compensation component to the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. To my right is Assistant Commissioner Rosalind Wade. Assistant Commissioner Wade oversees the Workplace Services Division component to the department. We will discuss what's in those components as we move through the course of this material. To my rear is Deputy Commissioner Michael Nielsen. Michael serves principally in a COO capacity at the department. He runs the chief operating units, the general services units within the Department of Labor and Industry. Next to Michael is Cindy Farrell, the department's chief financial officer. Although this department, or this committee in and of itself, doesn't take real jurisdiction over the budget aspects of our department, those issues obviously intertwine themselves with the policy issues at times, and should we have financial questions, Cindy is the one I go to. And last but certainly not least is Jamie Anderson. Jamie runs the legislative component to the department. She will serve as the department's primary conduit to the legislative branch. So as we move forward, hopefully that will help put a name with some, or face with some names. With that said, let's just move right into what we prepared as a PowerPoint. I can handle questions any way you guys wish to handle questions. I'm going to initiate the presentation by giving a relatively brief and high-level perspective of what the department does, and then we'll move into the functional components of the department at a more detailed level, and Assistant Commissioner Hargarten and Assistant Commissioner Wade will be playing a role in that piece of the presentation. So if there's no further questions, let's just roll right into it.
Please do.
Starting off by just pointing to the department's mission as well as our vision statement. This has been recently, in the last 2 years at least, crafted, so it is different than what you would have seen in either the Ventura or the Carlson administration. Our primary mission is to ensure a safe and equitable work environment for Minnesota employees and employers. Our vision being a trusted resource utilized by both employees as well as employers. Our primary activities are listed in the next page. The first being workplaces are free from injury and illness. This speaks primarily to our OSHA component. As we'll speak to again in greater detail, we run a bifurcated OSHA program with both a consultation and a compliance unit, which we hope creates a safer work environment. Secondly, injured workers are provided treatment and benefits required by law. This speaks primarily to our role as the workers' compensation policy entity within the executive branch. Thirdly, workers have the opportunity to receive critical skills through apprenticeship training. We also house the administration's apprenticeship program, where we regulate and approve apprenticeship programs as they relate to the trades. Fourthly, boilers and high-pressure piping systems are properly constructed, installed, and maintained. We, like four other agencies in state government, have a piece of the of code regulation. Our component parts relates to both boilers and high-pressure piping. And we have a series of or numerous inspectors that provide safety in those work environments. Finally, workers, potential workers, and employers have a clear understanding of their rights and responsibilities in the workplace. This goes to our Labor Standards Division. Our Labor Standards Division is the entity within the executive branch that provides oversight and regulation to issues such as minimum wage enforcement, prevailing wage enforcement, child labor law, issues such as those. From a functional, the next page speaks to what we do from a, not as much a program level, but from a functional level. We provide training and outreach. We provide training and outreach on a number of fronts throughout the department. We conduct inspections, audits, and investigations. Again, this is a broad-spanning functional activity that goes that runs throughout several of our divisions. We review workers' compensation claims and oversee the provision of benefits. We pay specific benefits to insurers and self-insured companies. This is done through our special compensation fund, which is housed at the department and does pay out significant benefit dollars to work comp claims. We provide informal dispute resolution services. This primarily relates to the world, again, of workers' compensation. We have a national leading adjudication process at the department in-house. We issue penalties for violations of the law. We have compliance units that are spread across the agency, ranging from OSHA issues, work comp issues, and labor standards issues primarily, code as well. And finally, we issue professional licenses and certification and register apprenticeship programs. So from a very high level perspective, that's what we do, from a functional perspective as well as kind of a divisional perspective. With that, I'm going to hand it over to Assistant Commissioner Hargarten, who's going to dive a little deeper into the world of workers' compensation.
If you could hold 1 second while we get a little administrative paperwork done, we have a quorum now, so I'll call the committee to order. The minutes of the last meeting are in front of you. Representative Severson moves their adoption after having thoroughly read them.
So moved.
And all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. Commissioner Hargarten, please, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, for the record, my name is Beth Hargarten, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner for the Workers' Comp Division at the Department of Labor and Industry. The workers' compensation system's purpose is to minimize the impact of work-related injuries and illnesses on workers and the employers. The law requires employers to purchase workers' compensation insurance for employees that have work-related illnesses, injuries, or disease. The law provides for wage replacement, benefits, medical treatment, rehabilitation when appropriate, and payment for permanent partial disability. The law also allows for dependency benefits in cases of death on the job. The Work Comp Division at Labor and Industry administers the workers' comp law. We maintain records, audit claims to ensure compliance with the law. We monitor rehabilitation and medical services and providers that provide those services. We answer questions and resolve disputes informally, and we pay certain types of workers' comp benefits. There are five units that you see on your PowerPoint presentation there that make up the Workers' Comp Division, and I'll go through those briefly. The first one, the Special Compensation Fund, reimburses insurers and self-insured employers for benefits that are being paid under two programs that are no longer in the law. However, they've got long-term tails to them. Those were the Second Injury Law and the Supplemental Benefit Laws. The fund, the Special Comp Fund, also pays benefits to injured workers whose employers have failed to purchase insurance as required under the law. So in those cases, we don't want injured workers to go without benefits because the employer didn't purchase insurance. So the state steps into the shoes of the insurance company, pays the benefit to the injured worker, and then we seek recovery from the uninsured employer. We also, that unit, the Special Comp Fund, also investigates cases of employers not having workers' comp insurance, and we do have penalties in the law for that. The next unit listed is the Customer Assistance Unit, or we call it CA for short, and they provide an awful lot of information about the work comp law to all people that are involved in it, injured workers, employers, insurance companies, health care providers. They handle over 3,000 hotline calls every month, so that's our main number for basic information. So they get about 3,000 calls a month there. They also attempt to resolve disputes early in the process and informally. The shorter the dispute process is, the better for everybody involved. It gets the injured worker back to work, gets their benefits sooner. It's better for the employer, and it doesn't create the tensions that usually litigation can create. So they use an awful lot of different ways of alternative dispute resolution to try to resolve those disputes and prevent an injured worker's case from going to an administrative hearing. The next unit listed is Compliance Services, or we also abbreviate that, for CS for short. And they monitor workers' comp claims to ensure compliance with the law. So they make sure that the benefits are getting paid in accordance with the statutory timelines and in the correct amounts to the employees. That unit also provides training to employers and insurers about the law and how to navigate through it. We monitor rehabilitation consultant providers, and we also certify and monitor certified managed care organizations in the work comp system. The fourth group listed there is Information Processing Center, or IPC. And that group provides centralized mail, shipping and receiving, and copy services for the entire department. They data enter all of our work comp files, they image all of the work comp documents, and they maintain all work comp files. Currently, we probably have about 1.3 million workers' comp files in our offices. And of that, approximately 575,000 are now imaged. So we are getting away from the paper. The last unit listed there is Vocational Rehab, and this unit provides rehabilitation services to injured workers, primarily where the injured worker's claim is being disputed. We want to get the injured worker back to work as soon as possible, and if there's a dispute, we don't want them to go without rehab services if they need them to get them back to work. So the Voc Rehab unit steps in and provides those services, and if in the end the claim is determined to be workers' comp covered, then we seek to recover money for the services that we've provided. One of the things that we were asked to talk about is any implementation of law changes that we've done in the last 2 years, and there really has not been much in terms of law changes in the work comp world recently. However, one thing that has happened is that we have moved a portion of our agency to the Department of Commerce. We had fraud investigators at Labor and Industry in the investigative services section that investigated workers' comp fraud. And a couple of years ago, the legislature determined that they needed, it would be good for the state to have a beefed up, so to speak, insurance fraud investigation unit to handle more than just work comp, to also expand into areas of auto insurance fraud or arson fraud, those sorts of things. So our investigators moved over to the Department of Commerce, and the Department of Commerce is in the process of hiring more staff and beefing up that unit to start investigating areas of insurance fraud other than work comp. We were also asked to talk about how our agency or how Minnesota's workers' comp administration compares to other states or what's going on in other states. And I guess I would say that we're very fortunate in Minnesota is that we're seen as a leader in a lot of areas in workers' comp, one of which is our alternative dispute resolution, which I mentioned in the customer assistance unit. We do an awful lot of mediation. It pays off to resolve disputes informally and early on before it gets more expensive and more contentious. And we're seen as a leader in that area. And other states, fortunately, are also beefing up their work in the mediation and alternative dispute areas. Another area where we are seen as a leader is in our treatment parameters. In the 90s, early and mid-90s, we developed a whole system of treatment parameters. And what those are basically best practices, best medical practices for treatment of work injuries. A number of states did not have treatment parameters. I believe some still do not. But those were used by a lot of states not only as a best treatment for injured workers, but also a cost containment measure. And another area where we are seen as kind of a leader is in our e-document management process. And by that what I mean is you heard me reference that we have about 575,000 workers' comp files that are imaged. We went to an imaging system in the mid-90s as opposed to paper, and it's been a phenomenal success. You can imagine if you have hundreds of thousands of workers' comp paper files, and if an injured worker calls you on the phone and says, you know, I just don't understand what's going on with my claim. Can you explain to me what this form is that I got in the mail? It would take us days to go find the file, get the file, call the employee back. And days is an awfully long time if you're a nervous employee and you need your benefits and you don't understand what's going on. So our image system enables instant access to anywhere in the agency to anybody's workers' comp file. So the minute we get a phone call from anybody asking about the status of the claim, what's going on with the claim, or what's in it, we can immediately pull it up on the screen and talk to them real time. It also enables us then to have instant conversations with the parties involved and resolve disputes right there on the spot. The other aspect that we were asked to speak about in terms of emerging issues in the workers' comp world, and what we've focused on the last couple of years, is medical cost containment. Unfortunately, we are seeing workers' comp costs in this state going up again. In the 90s, they were quite high. We had a number of different reforms that went through that lowered those costs, but unfortunately, we're seeing those go back up again. And we have a couple of slides here to kind of give you a picture of what I'm talking about. The actual rate of injuries in Minnesota is falling. However, our costs and what it costs the employers to provide that insurance is going up. So you'll see two charts there. Now, many of the, over the next couple of months, as you deal with labor and industry and workers' comp, we speak in terms of cost per $100 payroll and claims per 100. So you'll see that time and time again when you're dealing with workers' comp issues. So as you can see by the chart on the left, the number of claims since 1997 are actually going down, but our system costs have now started to increase after bottoming out in about 1999 and 2000. In 1992, we put in place, there was a reform package that was passed in the legislature in 92 to decrease some of the rising costs we had. And that was primarily in the medical area. So when I talked about treatment parameters before, that was what came out of the 1992 law, that in our fee schedule. But as you can see, after a decline from 1990, the costs were high. After the reforms went through, the costs started to decline. But unfortunately, it's going back up again, and quite sharply since 1997. One of our number of issues that we've discussed and what we're trying to focus on in work comp is pharmaceutical costs. And here you can see quite dramatically by the chart how drug costs have increased. And this is due to a number of things. The number of people that are receiving drugs is going up, the cost of medication itself is going up, and the way that workers' comp in Minnesota pays for drugs is different than other health care reimbursement systems. We pay quite a lot more in terms of reimbursements than general health does or Medicare does. Another area that we're focusing on is the treatment parameters. We did put those in place into law in 1992. Unfortunately, we don't have pharmaceutical treatment parameters, which is something that we're focusing on right now. But one of the reasons why we think treatment parameters are so important is because they are the best medical practices. These parameters are developed by the healthcare community. They are seen as the best medicine for certain sorts of injuries and illnesses. that get employees back to work faster and at a lower cost, but with the same improvements for the injured worker in terms of pain, function, and satisfaction. So unfortunately right now the parameters are not always followed. We'd like to see some changes in the law in that area so that they are followed because they do work.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, I do have a question about if you could elaborate on that, what the parameters are that are not followed.
Mr. Hargarten.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there's a variety of parameters in the law that designate what sort of treatment you should get for certain injuries, how long you get treatment, what type of treatment you get. They're not always being followed by both health care providers and the dispute resolution system, primarily the judges that oversee the cases when they go to the Office of Administrative Hearings. So either the parameters aren't being used or the parameter or people are going beyond what the parameters say. So they're giving different treatment than what is specified, or they're giving excessive treatment than what is specified.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Clark.
I think it would be helpful to have some detail on that because, you know, the one piece of data that says that people are returning, you know, with the same abilities they had, do we know if it's because in some cases they might be getting a little more extended treatment? I mean, is there any relationship between that? Or do we know that it takes longer because some treatments aren't provided? And so I'm just wondering if we can have some data on that. I think that would be helpful. It's just right now it's a vague statement that I can't really put together with the policy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we not a problem. We'll get you some follow-up data. We'll get follow-up information to all the committee members. Just to let you know, a couple of years ago the legislature asked the Department of Labor and Industry to convene a medical cost task force to look at the rising cost of medical treatment in the work comp system. So we did convene that about a year and a half ago, not this summer but the previous summer, and we had a variety of individuals on it that represented insurance companies, medical providers, chiropractic providers, pharmaceutical providers, and they had a number of meetings and looked at a number of areas in the work comp system where the medical costs have an impact. We have a lot of information that's on our webpage as a result of that medical cost task force, and it's broken down area by area. So there's an area on pharmaceuticals, what we talked about, what data we have, the comments that were submitted, treatment parameters. We also focus on that, managed care. So we can certainly get that to you, but just to let you know, if you're interested in looking at it right away, it is still on our webpage. And it is, if you go into our webpage and under workers' comp, there's a section there that says medical cost task force, and I believe the little icon looks like a doctor's bag with a red cross on it. So, but we will get follow-up information, Mr. Chair.
Okay, I have several other people on the list. I think you've got a few more slides to go through. Is that correct? Why don't we just finish those off real quick, and then we'll go through the questions on work comp.
Actually, in the work comp world, I think that is it for me. I was going to turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Wade, if you'd like to. I'm open for questions in the work comp.
Well, why don't we take a couple of those questions then, Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I did have a couple questions about the treatment parameters as well. similar to Representative Clark, I find the statement Minnesota's treatment parameters get employees back to work faster and at a lower cost with the same improvements in pain, function, and satisfaction interesting. Where is that statement coming from? Is it coming from the task force that you just discussed? Is it coming from data that the departments pulled together over time?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative, we did do studies on that, and we do have data on that.
Mr. Chair, the treatment parameters, as I understand them, apply at least in concept to all work comp injuries. Is that correct?
Mr. Hargan.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that is correct.
Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Hargarten, has there been any effort, thought, contemplation that you're aware of in using those treatment parameters that Minnesota's developed elsewhere throughout the country? You mentioned that we're seen as a leader. Have other states followed our lead?
Mr. Hargarten.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, other states have talked about implementing treatment parameters. Other states have implemented them. I think California, you may have read a lot in the not-so-distant future about the problems that California has. They have a lot of problems in terms of their budget, but one of their big problem areas has also been work comp and extremely high and extremely escalating costs, and they have looked at treatment parameters also.
One final question, Mr. Chair.
Mr.
Hargerton, can you tell us, in even if it's in general terms now, and if you could follow up with more specifics, do we have any idea what the cost savings have been with the treatment parameters, or where we'd be today if we didn't have them? I know there was one slide that showed about a $1,000 decrease in the cost. I'm wondering if we didn't have the treatment parameters in place, where we'd be today, if the department has any information in regard to that.
Mr. Hargard.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that is very hard to estimate. Because what you're saying, what you'd be trying to look at is what would people have done had they not had the treatment parameters. So you're guessing what the treatment would have been, what sort of services they would have provided, how long they would have lasted. It's basically just a guess. So it is very difficult to determine what would have happened had they not been there. It's much easier to look at what has happened in data in the past as the law changes.
Mr. Chair, is it safe to say, though, that at least from the department's perspective, the treatment parameters have brought down the cost while at the same time allowing employees who are injured at work to get back to work and continue to function as things were before the treatment parameters were put into place?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's entirely correct. They're both a cost containment method and their best medical practices, so they're best for the injured worker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We've got Representative Gunther, then Representative Liebling. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Hargarten, you mentioned that one of the things that is increasing the most is prescription drug prices for things. You know, the state buys a lot of prescription drugs. Do we have a state purchasing plan that can be used perhaps by labor and industry as far as work comp cases?
Mr. Chair,
Commissioner Brenner.
Gunther, let me answer that in a couple of respects.
Commissioner, could you speak in the mic a little more?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, let me make a couple comments about that. I also am a member of the Governor's Healthcare Cabinet.
I know that.
So I look at this issue beyond the parameters of the Department of Labor and Industry from time to time. Yes and no. We are a part now, through the Governor's Healthcare Cabinet process, as a prescription drug purchaser, we do now purchase in a coordinated fashion with DUER and the Department of Corrections and the Department of Human Services. But that purchase, that we have very small leverage with respect to the workers' compensation prescription drug market, because the state of Minnesota we're considered a competitive work comp state. We don't run a monopolistic process where the state is the payor generally. Folks either self-insure, if I'm a business entity, I either self-insure for workers' compensation or I pay an insurance company a premium to purchase a policy for workers' compensation coverage. So because of that, we don't usually pay out in most cases. The special compensation fund, from time to time, if it's an uninsured case, a bankruptcy, you know, then the state steps in to the special compensation fund, and we then do purchase. So for the small amount of purchasing we do, yes, we're doing it in a coordinated manner, but the vast majority of benefit purchasing is done by the private sector.
Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther asked the exact same question I was going to ask. Thank you.
Great. Representative Hollis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and you could provide an answer to this question later. Give it to the chairman, and he'll give it to the committee, but let's suppose someone is injured on the job and they go through rehabilitation and they go through the claim process and they can't go back to work, so they have a claim on for workers' comp and they're paid their weekly stipend, whatever that may be, and time goes on and they feel energized and ready to go back to work. They're better. they go back to work, they call the insurance company or you and say, discontinue my weekly benefit because I'm now employed. But a year or two later, it recurs. Or, worst case scenario, they're laid off from the job they got that they could do. Is there a time limit on how long they're eligible for work comp if they've collected for a while, gone back to work, and then the injury has recurred?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there's a variety of time limits in the law, and it would depend upon what sort of benefits they're getting. If you are completely unable to work after your injury, you're totally disabled. So the law talks in terms of temporary total disability. That is limited to 104 weeks. So you may collect 104 weeks. It's not 104 weeks from your date of injury. It's the collection of 104 weeks of benefits. There's also another benefit stream in the law called temporary partial benefits. Those are if you are unable to go back full time and your wage is less than what it was when you were first injured, that is 225 weeks of collection of benefits or 450 weeks from the date of injury, whichever one occurs first. And there are times when people will go in and out of those benefit streams. So they'll go back to work. You know, they may not be feeling up to going back full-time. They'll cut back to part-time. Then temp partial will come into play. So you kind of can go in and out of the benefit stream system. Now, in terms of the layoff question, you would not. You can only collect workers' comp benefit if the reason why you can't work is because of your injury. So if there's a layoff, the employer fires you for some reason other than work comp injury-related reasons, then workers' comp benefits don't necessarily automatically kick back in. They may if you are unable to find other work and you can't, and the reason why you can't find other work is because of your injury.
Representative House?
Just a quick follow-up then, Mr. Chairman. The 104 weeks, then, there is no time limit on the end. You said a total of 104 weeks, so assume someone was collecting disability for 52 weeks and then found employment that they could do, and the injury recurred 9 years later. We still open for the final 52 weeks, or is there a problem with that?
Mr. Hargay.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the law that's in place on the day that you're injured is what controls. So the 104-week would be what controls for that injured worker. So, yes, if the reason, if you go back to work, you're working, suddenly something happens, your injury re-flares up, you're again temporary, totally disabled, then you can recollect temporary total benefits up to your cap. What does happen is that the law changes, obviously, as time goes on, but the law that's in place for you on the date you're injured is what controls. So if the law changes next year and they decide that it's 52 weeks or it's 170 weeks, that's not going to change you. You're at 104 because that's what was in place when you were injured.
Thank you.
Okay, Commissioner Wade, want to go ahead and proceed with your presentation?
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Rosalyn Wade. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for the Workplace Services Division. Unlike the Workers' Compensation Division, where all of the activities are directly connected to the work comp system, the Workplace Services Division is comprised of four operational units with varied functions. The division consists of the following units: the Minnesota Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or Compliance Unit, the Workplace Safety Consultation Unit, Labor Standards and Apprenticeship, and Code Administration and Inspection Services. I will briefly describe the functions of each of those units. The Minnesota OSHA Compliance Unit of the department administers the Minnesota Occupational Safety and Health Act of 1973. The express legislative purpose of this act is to ensure safe and healthful working conditions for Minnesota employees. All places of employment covered by the Minnesota OSHA Act are subject to inspection to ascertain compliance with the men OSHA standards. We do adopt federal standards by reference. We also have the ability to adopt state-specific standards based on the needs unique to Minnesota. Inspections are scheduled following guidelines that are approved by the federal OSHA department and in accordance with the established priorities. The priorities are based on imminent danger conditions, catastrophes, fatalities, or serious injuries, employees' complaints, targeted industry inspections, and follow-up inspections. When violations are found, citations are issued specifying abatement dates for all violations. A monetary penalty may be assessed, which is deposited into the workers' compensation fund. Minnesota OSHA have offices located in Duluth, St. Cloud, Mankato, and of course, St. Paul. In addition to the physical offices, we also have staff that are well positioned throughout the state in order to respond in a prompt, efficient manner. The next unit is the Workplace Safety Consultation Unit. That is the voluntary or cooperative arm of the OSHA program. This unit provides consultation services upon request by employers to help prevent accidents and diseases through several assistant programs designed to assist employers before serious injuries, illnesses, or fatalities occur. It offers assistance on request to help both public and private sector employers improve their safety and health records, lower their accident and injury rate, and reduce the possibility of OSHA citations and penalties. The Workplace Safety Consultation employ consultants which will help employers recognize hazards, make recommendations for solving problems, and we're also able to suggest other resources that might be used to control hazards in the workplace. The unit is funded by a federal grant with state matching dollars coming from the assigned risk safety account. That account is a dedicated account within the workers' compensation fund. The penalties that are collected for violations of the workers' compensation laws are deposited in this account for purposes of administering safety programs. This account is used to support the activities of the Workplace Safety Consultation Unit. The unit administers several specialty programs, including the Safety Grant Program, which is a program that allows employers to apply for a grant of up to $10,000, which the employer has to match in order to address safety or health concerns within its workplace. The grant program was recently expanded to allow employers to apply for a grant for purposes of tuition reimbursement and also to provide training in the workplace. The other programs within that unit are the Labor Management Safety Committee Program. This is a program where both the employee and employer agree to utilize the services of our agency to advance safety and health in the workplace. We also administer the Workplace Violence Prevention Program. And most recently, this fund allowed the agency to hire two ergonomic consultants to be made available to assist Minnesota employers with voluntarily addressing ergonomics needs in the workplace. The Workplace Safety Consultation Unit also administer a number of partnership programs. Voluntary partnerships are, excuse me, consultation-based partnerships that assist employers in achieving safety and health improvement and recognizes the employer for doing so. There are 26 workplaces representing nearly 15,000 employees that are currently participating in the MnSHAR and MnSTAR programs. The unit also administers the Logger Safety Education Program. The unit administers the Logger's Targeted Industry Fund. This is another dedicated account within the Workers' Compensation Fund. An assessment is collected from wood mills based on the number of cords of wood produced. The Workplace Safety Consultation Unit sponsors safety training to employees in the logging industry, and logging companies are able to receive a rebate back from this account for those employees that complete annual safety training. The next unit of the division is the Labor Standards Unit. This unit advises and enforces state laws relating to employment standards, including minimum wage, overtime, wage claims, child labor laws, fee employment agencies, personnel files, parental leaves, the use of lie detectors in the workplace, and prevailing wage laws. Through outreach and education, the unit addresses various groups to instruct and explain the provision of the laws relating to its activities. The unit, on the subject of prevailing wage, the Labor Standards Unit determined the wage rates that must be paid on state-funded construction projects. These rates are determined by conducting surveys of wage rates paid for similar work in the area where the project is located. Upon complaint, the unit can examine payroll records to monitor compliance. The unit also provides posters explaining laws relating to minimum wage, overtime, and mandatory retirement. We also provide a number of educational brochures explaining laws about child labor, overtime and minimum wage, records and payment, and records and payment. This information is available by contacting the department, and it is also included on our website. The next function, although it's a part of the Labor Standards Unit, we merged the Labor Standards and Apprenticeship Unit 2 years ago. So apprenticeship and labor standards are now under the direction of a single manager. The Apprenticeship Unit registers apprenticeship and on-the-job training programs in Minnesota. It is the recognized approval agency for the U.S. Department of Labor. The unit is funded by the Workforce Development Fund and also by a $30 fee that is charged to the sponsors for each registered apprentice. Apprenticeship training is the formal system that combines both on-the-job training with related technical instruction. Training is designed to produce workers with expertise in all aspects of an occupation. The apprenticeship unit is also charged with approving and administering apprenticeship programs to ensure recruitment, selection, employment and training of the participant is done so without discrimination based on race, color, religion, national origin, sex, or age. The fourth and remaining unit of the division is the Code Administration and Inspection Unit. This unit is responsible for assuring the safe operation of boilers, pressure vessels, boats for hire, hobby boilers, and high-pressure piping and ammonia piping systems in Minnesota. through the adoption of regulations, licensing of its operators, pilots, and pipe and systems, and conducting inspections throughout the state. The specific services provided by the code unit includes the adoption of regulations governing the installation, the operation, and maintenance of boilers, pressure vessels, and boats for hire, and adopting regulations governing the installation of high-pressure piping systems. Our agency licensed the operators of boilers and boats for hire. We license installers of high-pressure piping. We issue certificates of inspections to owners of boilers, pressure vessels, and boats for hire. We issue permits for the installation of high-pressure piping. You also asked the same questions of my division regarding the implementation of 2003-2004 legislation. In 2003, legislation was enacted to establish the apprenticeship fee. The implementation of the fee, I would say it's been successful, although we've had some challenges. Again, in this area, Minnesota is being looked upon as a leader. Minnesota is one of the few states that have implemented a fee in the apprenticeship area. There's been a lot of debate and discussion around this issue. However, based on the feedback from other apprenticeship units throughout the nation, many states have looked to Minnesota for continued leadership on this. We've been the only state that have been able to successfully implement a fee. The fee is $30 per registered apprentice. There are four other states. Minnesota is one of four states with a fee for service in this area. The other states are Rhode Island, Connecticut, and Massachusetts. These states have provided feedback that they've not been successful, they've not been able to develop a system that tracks the apprentices throughout the program, throughout their years of being registered in the program. So in some states, they are waiting until the apprentices complete their apprenticeship training and then billing them. In other states, they have tiered systems where both the apprentice and the employer, our sponsor, pays a certain portion of the fee. There are additional fees tied to specific occupations and things of that nature. I spent a lot of time on this subject this past summer by convening a special task force to look at the implementation of the fee. And in fiscal year 04, fiscal year 03, I think I'm correct on this, the fiscal year ending this past July, there was a lot of challenges within around this subject. However, at the end of the day, we were able to significantly clean up our database. We found that prior to the implementation of the fee, our agency had carried outdated or erroneous information relating to the exact number of registered apprentices. Once the fee was implemented, that was the incentive that sponsors needed to provide us with very accurate information. I can say that beginning with July 1st of this fiscal year, we've had a much greater success of communicating with apprenticeship sponsors. We're very timely with providing the information to them, and in turn, each sponsor paid the fees that were assessed, and we were able to we were able to successfully collect all invoices that were billed on July 1st by September 1st. The previous year, it took us all the way to about the following May in order to get a clean accounting of their registered apprentices in particular programs. So I believe we're making significant success in that area. The other legislation that was enacted in 2003-2004 is the Code Services Surcharge. There's a $5 surcharge that was assessed per license issued for renewed boilers, boatmasters, and hobby boilers. A substantial amount of income was generated. That income was designed to provide resources that would allow the agency to hire two temporary boiler inspectors as well as an administrative assistant in that area. Speaking of temporary boilers, inspectors, we did fill those positions. However, we have strict regulations on who can be employed as a boiler inspector in the state of Minnesota. A boiler inspector must be commissioned by our national board in order to conduct inspections. Therefore, the applicant pool of available inspectors is quite limited. We were successful in hiring two inspectors. However, because of the temporary nature of the employment, both of these inspectors were subsequently recruited by the insurance industry that also participate in the inspection of boilers in Minnesota. Emerging issues. Many of you are probably aware that effective August 23rd, 2004, the Federal Department of Labor implemented changes to the overtime regulations. That change basically changed the specific criteria that is to be used in determining whether or not a professional, an executive, or an administrator is exempt from overtime regulations under the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act. Prior to the implementation, the agency received numerous inquiries. I was involved in the discussion. The commissioner was involved in the discussions. Our legal services unit, the labor standards unit. However, from the time that the changes were announced until the full implementation, a lot of positive things occurred. Based on the feedback that the Federal Department of Labor received through the comment period, many of the most objectionable parts of the regulations were amended. Specifically, the exemptions now include certain categories that will never be considered exempt. The named occupations include many of the construction work, firefighters, police. It listed these particular areas out, so it took them out of the discussion. In addition to that, it raised the dollar volume to up to $100,000 in certain areas. Therefore, some of the concerns where traditionally hourly paid employees no longer have to consider whether or not because of the hours worked, the total gross pay, or because they work overtime, those named occupations would never be considered exempt. That allayed many of the voiced concerns. we were also confronted.
Representative Goodnow, I think she's about finished, the commissioner, and if you could just wait a minute and then we'll take questions.
Thank you. It allayed many of the concerns. The feedback that our agency have received since the full implementation of the changes has been very limited. At first glance, many employees were concerned with, well, what's Minnesota going to do? The reality is the majority of employees are covered by federal law. Therefore, these changes have minimal effect on Minnesota law. Minnesota law enforces overtime after 48 hours. However, if the employer is subject to federal law, which allows overtime after 40 hours, then the more advantageous regulation prevails. In this instance, the federal law being more advantageous to most employees in the state. The number of inquiries, the areas of dispute seem to have slowed almost to a trickle. I am advised on a regular basis as to the number of inquiries and the nature of the concerns that the Labor Standards Unit receive on this subject. And since August, we're probably averaging just a minimal number of inquiries per week. Most of the inquiries are referred back to the federal because they are asking for specific guidance on the changes. And it not being our law, we're not in a position to provide advice. National and state issues. As I stated earlier, we are one of four states with an apprenticeship fee. We are considered a leader in that area. We've been asked to provide advice to other apprenticeship units on ways to successfully implement the apprenticeship fee. And on the issue of Minnesota OSHA, we are considered a significant leader in the OSHA world. We lead our region in OSHA partnerships. In addition to the partnerships that are administered by the Workplace Safety Consultation Unit, we also have partnerships within the Compliance Unit. We have four partnerships. Our partnerships are with the Associated General Contractors of the state. We have a partnership under review with the Associated Builders and Contractors of Minnesota. We have a partnership with Ford, and we have a partnership with the National Tower Erectors. The benefit of these partnerships is that we have a unique opportunity to sit at a table with the management of these associations and develop checks and balances on ways to produce and maintain good safety and health programs within the workplaces. That concludes my presentation. I'm open for questions.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner Wade. We've got several members on the list here. Simpson, Goodwin, Mullery, Howes, and Coles. Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Wade, just a little few questions about the prevailing wage. How is this information gathered, and how often is it gathered? And is it collected regionally or statewide?
Commissioner Wade.
Mr. Chair, Representative. The prevailing wage process includes two surveys, basically. We survey for a number of things. The survey is conducted annually. We begin the survey process by communicating with the county engineers. We communicate with the county engineers to help identify contractors who have performed work in their county in the previous year. With that information, we ensure that our mailing list is kept up to date. It doesn't usually produce many additions, but there are unique opportunities where a contractor is performing work, expanding their operation, and doing work in a county that they haven't done so before. With that information and updated list, we survey all contractors that we are aware of who have performed work in counties in the previous year. As I said, it is annual. We usually survey in the spring. We analyzed the data around June, and in the fall, the wage rates are certified for both highway heavy and construction for commercial. Commercial rates are set by county. Highway heavy rates are set by regions that are consistent with the MnDOT regions.
Representative Simpson?
So are we getting information from all counties, you feel?
Commissioner Wade?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we do get information from all counties. However, the information that we gather does not always produce exact rates for every category of labor.
Okay. Just one more follow-up.
Representative.
Commissioner, is this easily available to the public to get this information?
Commissioner Wade.
Mr. Chair, Representative, our wage rates are included on our webpage. Our staff is also available. We have noticed that since the rates were put on the webpage, the number of inquiries requesting faxed or mail copies of wage rates have dwindled. We used to send out faxes sometimes as many as 100 a day. Now that rate is probably down to less than 10 in a week. So the users of the system are aware that the wage rates are available on the web page, and they are using it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Assistant Commissioner. I have a couple of questions. The first one, I heard you say that you have safety and health consultants that answer questions about employment safety issues, and then I heard you say you have ergonomic consultants, so I was wondering what percentage of the work in your division is done by consultants or contracted out.
Commissioner Wade, are these state employees or are they outsourced consultants?
Mr. Chair, Representative, all of the consultants within the workplace safety consultation units are employees of the department. Their title is consultant. That clearly distinguishes them from the OSHA compliance investigators.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And another question I have for you.
Representative Goodwin.
Thank you. Assistant Commissioner, is the issue of the overtime pay, and you were naming some of the occupations that are exempt from that. With those positions, have you looked at whether or not those are union or non-union positions that are covered under the exemptions? Because you mentioned the ones you mentioned were normally union positions, like firefighters and police officers and whatever. So is that list mostly union positions that are exempt from the law and non-union positions, or normally non-union positions that are not exempt?
Commissioner Wade.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I guess in my review I didn't look at it from that perspective. It is quite an expanded, it's a voluminous list. Certainly there are many categories that are traditionally unionized, but I would hesitate to say that the dividing line is on union versus non-union. I will certainly go back and review that list and I can make it available, but I don't think that that's the premise.
Okay. Representative Goodman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One final question. I'm interested in this in what's happening with salaried versus hourly wage employees, and it seems like a lot more occupations are salarying their employees to get out of overtime pay and then having them work unlimited hours at that salary. Has your department looked at that issue? And if there's anything we can do to along those lines to protect employees from that.
Commissioner Wade.
Mr. Chair, Representative, in addition to the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act, we do have the Minnesota Fair Labor Standards Act, which was modeled after the original Fair Labor Standards Act. With that in mind, each of the categories establish specific criteria in which an individual may be considered exempt. So regardless of the wage rate, or just naming an employee as exempt or making them, regardless of an employer decision to establish a salary for an individual, the individual still must meet the criteria of the exempt categories, those categories being professionals, administrators, or executives. So there is clear, distinct criteria established.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple questions on prevailing wage, but Mr. Chairman, I just can't let something go. I know he's not here. I don't see Rukavina, but since he always zaps attorneys, I was wondering, a logger's education program, in view of him, is it, have we proven that they're educable? Or
Commissioner Wade, you don't have to answer that if you don't want.
And my next statement is, I hope a certain member of this committee is awake. I believe Commissioner Wade said that on prevailing wage, it is by county for commercial and by region for highway. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Mr. Chairman, would somebody shake a certain person who tells me about 2-3 times a year when I tell him that that's the correct answer, and he keeps telling me I don't know what I'm talking about? However, I do have two real questions.
Representative Hunter, to that point?
To that point, I would like to ask one question since he brought it up. Does the county wage tell you where the person who is bidding on the contract and working in that specific county is from?
Mr. Wade.
In other words, if somebody from Anoka comes to Martin County to do work, is that person registered under Martin County, or is it registered as somebody that has worked in Martin County for prevailing wage purposes?
Commissioner Wade.
Mr. Chair, Representative, let me try this. As I indicated, we conduct two types of surveys annually. First, we survey the county engineers. That is the best source to determine, to verify that work was performed in that county in the previous year. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
When the county engineer provide us information, we simply update our mailing list. We rely on the specific contractors to provide us information on work performed in a specific county and the wage rates that were paid on the project in that county. Therefore, if a contractor operates in the metro area but goes to Martin County, the survey will rely on the information that support that wages were paid in Martin County for that previous year.
For that contractor from Anoka.
Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Reverend Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hope he's got it right now. I have two questions. I know MnDOT has like full-time inspectors that are out in the field on prevailing wage. At one time, long ago, I know Labor and Industry did. Do you still have full-time inspectors in the field, basically finding out what's going, whether people are breaking it and investigating, and if so, how many?
Commissioner Wade.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do not have inspectors in the field for purposes of prevailing wage compliance.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. And Mr. Chair, second of all, how many penalties were issued last year for prevailing wage violations, and what was the median dollar amount, or roughly?
Commissioner Wade.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, before I answer that question, for the record, I'd just like to indicate that Labor and Industry does not have enforcement authority for purposes of enforcing the prevailing wage rate. Our role in the process is to survey and establish rates. We do have the ability to investigate if complaints are filed with our agency. However, our process is to examine the employer payrolls records, determine whether or not prevailing wage, the certified prevailing wage has been paid, and we turn that information back to the project owner or the contract owner. So we do not assess penalties in this area. We return the information back. I do not have a way of determining whether or not any penalties have been assessed. The Department of Transportation on highway heavy projects does have enforcement authority, but we do not.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I thought maybe I misunderstood it. You said you get the contractor's records and examine them and turn them back to the owner?
The contract owner.
Commissioner.
The contract owner. Mm-hmm. So the employer of the people, of the workers? Is that what you're saying? In other words, who is the contract owner?
Commissioner Wade.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the contract owner can be a county. It could be a school district. It could be other sources. It would not necessarily be the direct employer of the employees.
Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, do you have authority to turn it over? You said you don't have the enforcement. Is it the? I would assume then it's the local county attorney that has the enforcement. If it's not you, or is it the AG? And do you turn over the case or notify them of violations or something like that? Either the county attorney, first explain whether it's the AG or the county attorney that has the authority, and then. Do you indicate, hey, looks like there's a violation here or something?
Commissioner Wade.
Mr. Chair, Representative, violations of the prevailing wage law is a misdemeanor. Therefore, it falls under the jurisdiction of the county attorney. I forgot the second half.
Oh, do you notify the county attorney that there's a violation or possible violation or something?
Commissioner Wade.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, we do not.
Okay. I have several other people on the list, but I note that Commissioner Brenner has an appointment that he has to leave for at 2 o'clock. Appointment with the governor and Dr. Phil. So, if there's any specific questions for Commissioner Brenner, otherwise we'll just go through the list as on there. Seeing none, Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and you can provide the answer to the chairman so you can take your time. It's with your apprenticeship program. Obviously, grocers and lawyers don't go through that. But if you could provide the chairman with a list of types of jobs or trades that you have in the program, what the program cost in, say, 2003 or 2004, whatever year is available for you, and most importantly, what the success ratio is with people who have gone through the program. Did they get employed, and are they still employed? Are they still employed?
Yep. We've got that down, and we'll follow up.
You do?
Yep.
Thank you.
The committee administrator. Representative Poles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to prevailing wage. I understand the survey process, I think, but what I'm looking for a little clarification. Let's say you send out the survey and you get 10 contractors in Martin County who 6 of them said we paid $30 an hour and 4 of them said we paid $20 an hour. How does the department go about calculating the prevailing wage? Is it an average? Is it how's that work?
Commissioner Wade.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the statutes require that the wage rate be determined by the exact wage rate paid to the largest number of employees. So, in the example you gave, six employees being paid $30 an hour and four employees being paid a different wage rate. That wage rate would be certified at the $30 an hour.
Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, how does the way that the department does it here in Minnesota, how does that compare to other states? Is that the common practice to do that, to do the calculation that way? I guess I'm a little surprised that there's not any averaging or anything like that. Is that the way it's done across the country?
That's your way.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are probably about 20 states that have what's known as the Little Davis-Bacon Law. In those states, the way the rates are computed vary. Some of them are based on weighted average. Some of them are simple majorities. Some of them adopt collectively bargained rates for individual trades. So there is not a common thing. As far as other states that utilize a method similar to Minnesota, I believe that we are the only state that uses the modal calculation. In the state of Missouri, they use something similar, but it is not as clear-cut as the exact number. It doesn't compute to the mode.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, it's always interesting, even when you've been here a long time, to have an overview, because it's always something new to learn or a gap to discover. And I must say, I must have missed this in previous years, that if we have a wage violation, our Department of Labor and Industry does not have enforcement abilities to deal with that wage problem. Is that correct? And if so, well, it's correct, right?
Mr. Wade.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do not have enforcement authority for prevailing wage enforcement.
And Mr. Chairman, how about minimum wage or any other wage standards that we have worked so hard to pass here in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Wade.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do have enforcement authority for minimum wage violations.
Excellent. And so, Mr. Chairman, when those violations occur, is the enforcement done directly through your agency or with the Attorney General, or are we leaving it to local officials? Or can you just give me a brief overview of how that enforcement is, child labor, minimum wage, any of those important areas?
Commissioner Wade.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, in the area of minimum wage, overtime, and child labor law, we've been quite successful in working with Minnesota employers when violations have come to our attention. What occurs is it's usually complaint-driven. We have the authority to audit payroll records. We make our determination. We communicate with the employer. If we are unsuccessful in recovering the back wages, we do turn it over to the Attorney General's office.
Mr. Chair, and then maybe would the department, well, I don't know, maybe you can't speak here today, but I'm wondering if you would think about and maybe get back to us, if nothing else, on whether or not you'd be interested in being given the authority to deal with the prevailing wage issues, too. I think when it's left to a local community, that can be pretty tough on some of the enforcers out there, and so I'm just wondering if that would be something you, Commissioner, could let us know today or another time, if you might be interested in having the department have that authority.
I'm not sure, Wade. Do we care to comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, we'd obviously be interested in talking to you about the subject. Prevailing wage, as many of you know, raises significant concerns with the legislature generally, but we could work through those concerns. We'd certainly be willing to work the issue.
Okay.
Yeah, sure.
And then just one final question.
Representative Clark, absolutely.
Assistant Commissioner Wade, you were very thorough in your presentation, as you said. Thank you. I was listening when you went through the list of protected classes under the labor standards, and I think I heard a couple not there, and I'm just wondering if you could see that list again, please.
Commissioner Wade.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I was speaking on behalf of the apprenticeship program. One of the charges of our staff is to monitor the program to ensure that apprenticeship sponsors make apprenticeship programs available and to ensure that discrimination does not take place with regards to the recruitment, the selection, the employment, and the training of the participants. The categories that are listed in our rules, I believe, are race, color, religion, national origin, sex, or age.
Chairman, Commissioner, are you not covered by the Minnesota Human Rights Statute?
Commissioner Wade.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would expect that we are.
Mr. Chairman, there's at least two categories I didn't hear there.
Representative Clark.
One of them is disability, the other is sexual orientation. And I'm just wondering if there's a reason those are not part of the statute. I guess it's your rules. Is there a reason those are not part of your rules?
Commissioner Wade.
Mr. Chair, Representative, not that I'm aware of. There isn't a reason that I'm aware of.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Clark.
I'd expect a correction then in that rule.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I don't know the history on why those are not in there, but we certainly are open to including them. We're not playing any funny games by not trying to include them.
Mr. Chair,
I don't know when those rules were promulgated. Right.
Representative Clark.
I have one final question in this category. One of the groups of people who I represent who describe a lot of discrimination to me and may be covered under this, but I'm wondering if you're getting any complaints, and that's the national origin. And what I'm talking about, is, and I think we might have an appointment to talk about this, is the practice of some employers of hiring many of our new Americans who are not yet citizens, but they're here legally, they're working hard, they're working at some of the hardest jobs, low-paying jobs, so on. And there's a practice growing, as I understand it, it's been reported to me, of hiring particularly these individuals for 6 months during the probationary period, and then not giving them a chance to compete for a full, a permanent job. And I'm just wondering, it seems like that would be covered under this list if you're talking about national origin. If not, I'm wondering if we need to look at that. And I'm wondering if you have gotten any of those complaints like I have.
Commissioner Wade.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I have not been made aware of any complaints in this area.
Chairman, I look forward to me working on this with the Commissioner and the staff then, because this is a real concern of some of our, of our new Minnesotans who really do want to have a permanent job, and they just are running into this over and over.
I understand. Commissioner Wade, I have one real quick follow-up question to an earlier question of Representative Clark's. With regard to enforcement, have you ever had a situation where you brought the violation to the proper authority, whether the county or whoever the contract owner is, and it wasn't remedied?
Mr. Chair, not that I'm aware of. We've been quite successful with working with the contract owners.
Okay. Thank you very much. Representative Saylor.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to go back to the loggers education. I just needed a little more information. I just wondered if you could explain further how this would benefit any loggers that are not affiliated with the mill, with the very, very private guys that are just out in the woods. Does that program cover them or not?
Commissioner Wade.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the logger education program was made available to address the serious injuries that were occurring in the loggers industry. Back in the late 80s, there was a lot of discussion where the cost of workers' compensation insurance for the logging industry was proving to make conditions where logging companies could not operate with a profit. The logger safety education program was then developed to permit individual loggers to participate in the safety training. The rebate, however, is a different function of that. The safety training itself can be made available to all loggers regardless of their affiliation. However, the rebate is what the logging companies apply for.
Let me clarify that a little bit.
Commissioner Brenner. This
issue, for some reason, seems to be confusing. We assess by the court, Department of Labor and Industry, that amounts to, I believe, $1.1, $1.2 million a year. A million of that goes back to the logging industry to offset workers' compensation claim costs. The remaining dollar, this is that one. The remaining dollar fund, I think it's about $125,000, goes to the Department of Labor and Industry. We have a full-time logger who's out there on the road in the forest working with individual and group settings to loggers on everything from, you know, CPR to proper logging procedures to now they're looking at meth even to some degree because that's become a problem out in the forest areas. So the safety component to the program is accessible to the entire logging industry. Mills reap the $1 million in work comp offset costs. Does that help,
Professor?
Yes.
Okay, Representative Yaros, and then I'd like to let the commissioners wrap up. Okay. Representative Yaros.
Mr. Chairman, I was going to ask a question when we discussed workers' comp, but I go back to workers' comp and I have a question. Okay. Commissioner Beth, I forgot your last name, I'm sorry.
Harder.
Okay. It seems like I get more calls from injured workers having problems collecting their benefits from insurance companies than just about any other complaint that I get. And then many of these injured workers have to hire an attorney to be able to collect their benefit. It takes a long time. They're they're not able to work, and they have to wait and pay to get their benefit. Is there a way to resolve this besides having a state-run workers' comp like unemployment comp? I hardly get any calls about unemployment comp, but workers' comp is the problem with private insurance companies.
Commissioner Harger.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, my answer to you and to all representatives here that may have constituents that have work comp problems, the first thing I'd like an injured worker to do is to call us. And there's numbers in here, our 800 number. Call our customer assistance people because they are very good at resolving disputes informally and quickly before it gets to the stage where a person has to go out and hire an attorney and then it's got to go to a hearing and then it gets dragged out and all that sort of thing. I think one of the reasons why you see a difference between unemployment insurance benefits and workers' comp benefits is because the work comp law has an awful lot of provisions in it that give, it's an exchange of rights is what it is. The employee gets certain benefits and the employer gets certain benefits. But the employer also has the ability to dispute whether or not a claim occurred on the job. So if you're unemployed, you're either unemployed or you're not. If you're injured, you could have been injured at work, but you could have been injured someplace else. So there's workers' comp is more complicated. There's more opportunities for debate. There's and disagreement. And I think that's why you all as representatives may get more constituent calls in that area, but please, if you ever have a workers' comp issue, we strongly encourage your constituent to call our agency because many times we can resolve those just by getting the insurance adjuster on the phone or getting the employer on the phone, and we try to get it done so that people don't have to seek legal counsel and expend a lot of time and money.
Okay, thank you very much. Commissioner, would you like to wrap up or any closing comments?
I can basically stand for questions. We had one other slide on there. It just reflects some internal operational efficiencies we've been successful with over the last year or two. For those who know me, they know I'm a driver, effective business efficiency and relevant technology incorporation. So we've tried to do some things to lower our costs at the same time provide better customer service treatment to our constituency base. Let's reflect it. I don't need to work through those. With that, I would just, suggest if any question, any concern comes up. Many of you know me. I've been around to some degree. Many don't. I see a lot of new faces. I hope to meet you this session. I am very accessible, and I hope that we have the opportunity to work any potential issues you may have for the course of this session.
Commissioner and commissioners, thank you very much for your time. Appreciate your efforts, and we're adjourned. Thank you.